difficult news story week. There's no question about it. We left the airwaves at 9 o'clock last week on Friday, and this horrible story that happened at Young and King that really isn't related to transit, hit all our airspaces, and it was like a punch in the gut. And I think we've had a lot of subsequent punches in the gut. The hope is to minimize these stories. The hope is to turn some of these narratives around. Those of us who like good news stories more than bad news stories would love to talk less about these obvious things. So a move made yesterday to put more police on the scene. Some will be undercover, some will be in uniform, but it is going to be noticeable, and I think you'll spot it pretty instantaneously. John Birdside is the chair of the TTC, a former police officer as well, and the counselor for Don Valley East. Thanks for joining the show on short notice, John. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Greg.
When you get elected in the fall and then you get named TTC chair, you probably didn't forecast the January that we've all seen. This is a big challenge. It's a big challenge for a lot of people involved to sort of not just change the narrative, but turn some of the data around and get people confident in riding transit.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a bit of a tsunami. And of course, the question is, how do we reverse what's going on?
So yesterday's announcement, what do you think it does for consumer confidence?
Well, I think it's a necessary first step, but it's only one step, and it's obviously more of a shorter term solution. Longer term, we have to look at all the mental health supports and what's going on in our city as a whole. But short term, for sure, I think people are going to feel safer. I know I was in New York before Christmas and seeing two police officers at the entrance to the subway. I felt safer. But it's also having people present where riders can actually report things. Currently, if there's a very serious situation, someone has a knife, you hit the yellow strip on a train. If it's just someone sleeping, you may or may not report it. But it's those people in the middle who are in obvious signs of distress and who might be escalating their behavior, where you need someone that you can reach out to quickly, and you may not want to hit the yellow strip on the train, and who can deal with it, whether it's police intervening or getting streets to homes workers there quickly, whatever the case is.
So most of these will be, if I understand, off-duty officers in an overtime capacity. Are those off-duty officers that are volunteering for the overtime? Will cops be asked? How will it work?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not, I can't speak for the chief of police, but my understanding is, of course, you can't force officers to take that type of overtime, or you can't force them to do pay duties, whatever the case might be. So I suspect it will be on a volunteer basis.
There's so much there, isn't there, with and I know there's people and people who are going to criticize the adding of cops saying, well, this won't be the only thing that changes it. But there isn't any one thing. There is no one magic solution to turn this around. This is going to be about five or six different puzzle pieces, and they'll all have to sort of fit together and bake together over time, won't they?
Well, that's right. And I mean, short term, the thing that we can do the quickest, and I think is probably the most effective in the short term, is getting that sort of surge of the number of police officers. But absolutely, I mean, when we have a situation, in these random attacks, I think they're probably there's more of a mental health angle to it. And the question is, why is it escalated? Is it other municipalities, which I actually worked in the encampments for a year and a half before this position, speaking to people, I know for a fact, well, I can't necessarily prove it, but speaking to the people in the encampments, they're given tickets to come to Toronto. Right. So are other municipalities sending people who need help to Toronto for that help? And are they overloading our system? Are they concentrating the number of people who need help? I mean, that's just one slice of the problem. And that's why I wholeheartedly support the mayor's call for a national summit, as it were, on the mental health crisis that we're facing.
I'm glad you said that, John, because you bring up that one scenario where things just seem to intersect and conflict. It is the city where you could get the most help in if you're struggling from mental health issues and have been for a long time. It's also the most expensive city. And I would make the case, if you are suffering from an addiction, it's got the most temptation here. Like it has that. So some of these things intersect where you can get the help, but you can also fall right off the path of getting back to your life to a more positive sense.
Well, you're bang on, Greg, and I would say that there's more temptation than there is help, and that's one of the challenges, right? I mean, when we're talking mental health, of course, this is all, you know, health care is a provincial responsibility, and we're the City of Toronto especially is having to step into that breach, but where is the province in all of this, and where is the actual strategy? I think people feel that we're just going from one crisis to the other. Let's have a robust strategy, but we need to get the province and actually the federal government when it comes to housing to the table.
John Burnside's our guest counselor for Don Valley East, chair of the TTC, joining us on Toronto Today. As a former police officer, what's your reaction when you just hear and read all the stories of the young people, like kids 13 to 16? They are still kids. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be accountable for their own actions, but most of us are just beyond shocked because we used to be that age and we knew the distinction between, you know, acting out and a prank and this and that and just random wanton violence. And obviously this hit 100 miles an hour before Christmas with the story of the 8 teenage girls arrested. You probably never saw anything like this as a police officer starting out, did you?
No, and I mean, you know, I was a police officer for 10 years, about 20 years ago, so definitely seemed like a different time. It appears that the age of, I'll say, delinquency, and I'm not talking about the random stuff that kids do, but the actual serious crimes, it's getting younger and younger, and this has been happening in the States. I mean, there are well-documented cases of 12-year-olds murdering people in the States, and, you know, now we're in Toronto, we're at 13-year-old girls. But, you know, where kids have the most influence or get their the greatest influencers are parents. And I think at some point as a society, we also sort of say, hey, what's the personal responsibility of parents? And I know that's a larger discussion as well. And once again, government seems to always have to step into the breach, and I get it. But it's got to be a coordinated approach. Like, why, if these girls did are actually found guilty and did commit that crime, like, why are they wandering around looking to do that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long history of youth justice, and obviously the Young Offenders Act was changed, something I remember as a kid thinking about and talking about, and it morphed into the Youth Criminal Justice Act. But I just find there's an awful lot of people, because to me, this is not sometimes a, you know, economic desperation. This clearly isn't a homeless issue. There are obviously 13, 14-year-olds that are on the street, but the ones that are committing crimes are leaving a home in the morning and going back to the same home that night. And this is just a matter of accountability and, as you say, delinquency, it feels like.
Well, absolutely. And I think that you just hit on a really important point, is that we often conflate issues. We conflate poverty with, criminal behavior. Is there a link? Maybe, but that doesn't speak for everyone. We conflate homelessness and mental illness. Absolutely, there's a relationship, but is every person who's acting out in a violent way, as a result of mental illness, are they all homeless? Right? I mean, we need to ask those sorts of questions. We need to understand exactly where the problem, you know, the background and the problems, where they're coming from, as opposed to making these wide statements about, okay, we just need more housing. Absolutely. But housing alone has to be supportive. And there are a lot of other steps. And sometimes I think as politicians and as a society, we simplify things when they're actually complex.
John, how much time do you need for some of this impact and some of the changes and more police to sort of bake in and look at data and say, we think we might have something here amongst other issues and think that it's working? Do you need a month? Do you need a couple months? When would the tide turn based on numbers you'd look at?
Well, I'm hoping in days, right? You can't guarantee anything, but I know the chief did mention that, you know, where those 80 officers are going to be deployed is all going to be data-driven. So what time of day do most of these incidents occur? Or is it a specific streetcar line? Or is it certain subway stations? Because, of course, the police can't be everywhere. You wouldn't need, you know, you need a lot more than 80 officers, but we need to get the maximum benefit out of their presence, hopefully their deterrence, and hopefully de-escalation of situations. So that's going to be data-driven. It's going to change over time, but I'm hoping it's a matter of days, not weeks.
John Burnside, thanks so much for the time today. Have a great weekend, and thanks for letting us reach out to you on short notice. I hope we can do it again. These are such important conversations, and you got a huge role into this. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Greg.
John Birdside joining us.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.